Well, so that everyone will know what's going on in this studio, my name is Bill Andrews, and I'm an employee of the National Broadcasting Company, KNBC, but I'm here purposely to talk to and interview and rehash old times with two wonderful people, and so that their voices may become identified, I'll ask first for the voice of Carlton Morse. How are you, Carlton?
I'm fine, Bill. What do you mean, only here? As a matter of fact, you began, you were the first announcer for the first program I ever did for NBC in 1929. A pretty important personality in my life. And, of course, next to me here is Mike Raffetto, who is known as Paul of One Man's Family, and for many other things that he wrote and acted in through the years of NBC. Mike?
Well, we're here, and we've reached the age now, I suppose, where we're called back to reminisce. And this is always a pleasant thing to do. And I made a couple of notes about things that used to go on in 1930. And I remember one thing in particular. We always had to dress in dress clothes after 8 o'clock. All programs all had to be in dress clothes. And so we'd leave this dinner jacket up in the mezzanine, and all the actors would come in and get into a dirty dress shirt. It was almost black, but it met the requirements. And then, in those days, the sound effects, we had a boy, a sound effects boy.
He wasn't a sound effects man, he was a sound effects boy.
He was a boy. And he usually missed cues, and so all the actors had to help out with sound effects. So I can remember we'd do a Western. If you weren't actually speaking, then you'd get down with half coconuts on the floor in dress clothes, making the horse ride in, you know?
The horse's hooves.
The horse's
with coconut shells.
Coconut shells. Yes. That's one of my reminiscences. And then, well, I'll pause and let somebody else talk, and then I'll come up with something else.
Carlton?
I started to work for NBC in September of 1929, the same month as the crash.
Stock market crash?
The stock market crash. One of my friends who came to work about the same time, Dresser Dolstead, now a producer in Hollywood, came to work, was hired the day or a week before the crash, and came to work the Monday after the crash, and received a cut on his first day of work. But during those days, the thing that was so very pleasant was there was no standards of writing, or you were turned loose and think of something and do it. And out of these things, this maelstrom of confusion came so many of the shows that later developed into Coast and National shows. But this this turmoil, everybody with an idea, working. It was a wonderful time. It was the new era of in a new medium, and everybody had his opportunity.
Another way of saying it, Carlton and Mike, is that every step that we took, every time we put our feet forward and opened our mouths on the microphone, every time you hit that typewriter in preparing these plays and writing these scripts, we were exploring the unknown, literally. Isn't
right.
that true?
It certainly was true, and sometimes the bottom dropped out of things, and chaos took place. We had one director who was so inept that he never could time a script right. So in the middle of a show, he would come in to the actors who were on air with their pages of script, and he would thumb through the scripts in front of their mind and point to a line for somebody to pick up out of the empty air. And this was how he cut scripts on the air. You remember that, Mike?
Yes, I remember him very well. And to cover himself, of course, he was usually a little drunk. And to cover up, look, and he would give a hurry-up signal and a slow-down signal in tandem so that he was safe. So he gave both signals, and it was the actor's fault if we didn't get off.
Right. Do you remember a very fine old gentleman, an actor, who came very often into the studio a little bit high, and sitting in the booth, I could always tell where Charlie was in his cups, because if he tried to pretend that everything was all right, so he would read a line and then he would run up and look in the booth to see if everything was there. If you nodded, everything's fine, and he would do this during the whole show. Then you knew you were going to get a bad performance out of Charlie.
Waiting for the nod of approval.
That's right.
You know, I think we should say a word too about the importance of this area, that is Northern California and San Francisco, to the whole story and life of radio, because, believe it or not, in those days, there did not exist a transcontinental network. And here in San Francisco, we duplicated everything that was done originally in New York. As a matter of fact, there was no such thing as airmail. And so the scripts would be performed in New York with New York casts, orchestras, and directions. And these would then be sent by train to San Francisco. And we, in turn, would pick up some of this stuff and repeat it for the Pacific Coast Network, because the network transcontinentally did not exist at that time.
This, until we got tired of doing that and did our own.
We did our own, that's right. And it was Carlton who established himself as one of the great radio dramatists of all times right here in San Francisco, with the assistance of casts and actors such as Mike, who is across the mic from me right now. Mike, how do you want to comment on that?
Well, of course, it was Carlton's writing that gave us a certain amount of fame and some security, because in the early days before the family, it was not unusual to get $5 for a performance, and I can remember we were all under contract, subject to how many calls we'd get in. It was with great excitement and anxiety that we'd get our casting sheet each week and open it up to see how many programs we had. And with some of them, of course, this was in 1930 and 31, in the midst of the Depression. And so it was with great anxiety that we opened this envelope to see how many programs we had. And very often, we didn't have enough to make ends meet, and we would go to Daly City to try to help out the income at a gambling place. And that often...
Mike, those existed at that time.
Yes, they existed. This was during Prohibition, and this is 30 years ago, so I'm sure it's all now pure. But we would go down and gamble, and I remember Bart and I, many times coming out, the man would give his car fare back, and we'd get on the trolley car. And I remember dear old Bart saying, as he got on the trolley car one night, he had a little child, he said, "I don't think I'll be able to pay the baby this week."
And, excuse me, when they come back, then each of us would sign the other's Morris Plan notes, and that's the way we'd live from week to week. Actually, there's an institution that we probably founded and supported for many years. We should part owners, which unfortunately we are not.
I think we could comment too on that matter of income. In those days, $27 a week or $25 a week was rather a magnificent sum, wasn't it, Mike? Sometimes it was as little as $9 a week.
Yes, of course, it's so relative, but we were happy to get $10 for a performance, and this was a handsome fee.
Now, you mentioned Bart in your conversation just a moment ago. That I know you were referring to Barton Yarborough, who played Cliff on One Man's Family.
Yeah.
Yes, and we lost Bart in 1951.
Also in those days, referring again to the pioneering that was done, we had a staff of artists and musicians. By artists, I mean singers, actors, actresses, musicians, conductors, producers, writers. That was, I would estimate it was probably 225 to 250 in number, wasn't it, Carlton?
I would think so. I know the halls at 111 Sutter were cluttered with humanity from early in the morning until midnight, and everybody seemed to be busy. Studios were crowded. It was a fabulous era for radio. It opened a whole new vista of program ideas and personalities.
There was such a hard rule against. There was no such thing as a recording, even for a sound effect. You remember that, Bill?
Indeed, indeed.
Every sound effect had to be done manually, and there was no nothing could be done by way of a record.
Well, actually, Mike, they didn't, when we started, they didn't have
exist.
Recordings. We had no such things as recording a program. I mean, all the early shows of One Man's Family were completely lost because there was no way of recording them. They were just starting in those days to...
Let's see if we can remember some of the methods and means of simulating sound effects. For example, Mike a moment ago mentioned the coconut shells on the floor for horses' hoofs galloping across the plains and whatnot. I recall whenever there was a scene in the snow and people were walking through heavy crusted snow, we'd use a tiny bag of cornstarch, a cloth bag of cornstarch, put it close to the microphone, and we'd twist it, and it'd go squeak, squeak. Just like snow walking on snow. Yeah. What about fire in the fireplace or whatever? Or frying eggs? How did you fry an egg in those days on the air?
They fried an egg. but I was thinking for one time we wanted the waterfall, and we took a mic into the men's room and turned on the faucets in the basin and put the mic close enough and got the mic wet and
a veritable Niagara
and got into trouble with the engineering department. you used all sorts of your own ingenuity and according to the later sound effects, I suppose it had been pretty bad. But everything was so new and everything was accepted so wholeheartedly. This is the terrible thing that I regret, is that the public has lost its naivete. It has become sophisticated to the point where it wants not entertainment, but perfection, to a point where new ideas are not as important.
Well, here we've been talking... Carlton Morris, author, radio dramatist, original author of one, only author of One Man's Family, director, producer of the program, and Mike Raffetto, who played that wonderful part, Paul. My name is Bill Andrews. I'm still at NBC. And we've done all of this as part of the KNBC KPO 40th anniversary, 40 years. Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Congratulations to KPO.
Congratulations to KPO.
And to KNBC.
And to KNBC.